Good afternoon. I'm Alice Randall, and I'm here to take you on a trip to the other side of the tracks. And when it's all over, we'll be just a few blocks from where we started, but I hope just a bit changed. And you're going to get to hear some country music this afternoon, starting with 16 Tons. Just a little bit of each of these songs.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
That's country. 16 Tons, written by Merle Travis, performed by Tennessee Ernie Ford. I suspect the sentiment of working hard, being another day older and deeper in debt is not completely unfamiliar to the families of students and to the students themselves graduating from extraordinary but expensive colleges all over this country this spring. Welcome to Country Music 101, a very brief introduction to America's peculiar poetry, the country song lyric. Before we get started in earnest, and this may be the place to recognize that country music is neither afraid nor ashamed to get earnest, let me stop to congratulate you, the members of this audience. This lecture is part of a celebration. We are gathered on the Vanderbilt campus to celebrate the accomplishments of the class of 2007, and we are gathered to celebrate those who support and have supported the class of 2007 as they strode and sometimes struggled towards this day we call commencement. In the idiom of the country lyric, this is the good stuff. One of the places in life where we encounter the reality that the hard work of life can be the sweet reward of life. The occasion of our gathering, graduation, provides a stark and dramatic frame for consideration of the country lyric. Child rearing and childhood remembered, including and often focusing on the part of childhood that overlaps with adult life, are common themes in the country canon. And while it may seem obvious to many of us in this room that the young people who graduate tomorrow are fortunate, a look at just a few of the country childhood narratives will remind us of something far less obvious, that we, who are well able to provide for our children, are fortunate as well. Take a listen to a song written and sung by Merle Haggard, Hungry Eyes.
A canvas covered cabin in a crowded labor camp. Stand out in this memory. Cause my daddy raised a family there with two hard-working hands and tried to feed my mom's hungry eyes.
A canvas-covered cabin in a crowded labor camp. Alliteration doesn't get better than that in 20th century American poetry. A canvas-covered cabin in a crowded labor camp. Subtle parsings of class, Oedipal competition, and the role of both poverty and the divine in an increasingly industrial and secular nation don't either. Unless you start thinking about Tom T. Hall, the man songwriters in Nashville refer to as the storyteller's storyteller, and his song, I Hope It Rains at My Funeral. That's Merle asking for a little bit more Merle. And here we should be getting, wait. Here's Tom T.
A man with 40 acres plowed and planted can't send no 14-year-old boy to no school. The only thing I learned in the years I worked on my daddy's farm was, son, you better get them crops in when it turns cool. In the magazines, I saw the naked women. I heard about the drinking and the bars. If my daddy could have caught me, he'd kill me. He said, you might run, boy, but you ain't gonna get far. I hit town, or you might say that it hit me. Next morning, there were things I knew more about. The woman who had taken me in said, country boy, you're all right. The same way I turned her on, she turned me out. The first wall I broke, right away they got me. I helped them build the country roads for a while. They fed me 2 times a day and knocked me down about 4. For 30 days I didn't even crack a smile. Met a nice girl and she said I was her baby. She let me go and would never tell me why. I learned what it means.
I learned what it means to be somebody's baby. They let you lie in your bed by yourself and cry. Our children have received a very different kind of education, yet and still I believe they and we have much to learn from the lyric of the country songs, much about this country's history, much about privilege, much about psychology, and much about language. It's been my pleasure this spring to introduce a new course to the Vanderbilt campus, English 28803, The Country Lyric in American Culture. It was an exhilarating challenge to lead 30 Vanderbilt students as they engaged in both scholarly research and field research on and off campus in an effort to document the lives of songwriters, document the impact of specific country songs, and perhaps most significantly, work to provide structured analysis and close reading of thematically related country songs, all in an effort to explore the aesthetics and linguistic strategies of the country lyric. Country music, is it a hard music for a hard people or a cliched music for a sentimental people? Do all country songs sound alike, or is country music as diverse as the nation that birthed it? Three chords in the truth, or reverb, synthesizers, and platitudes? Intricate psychological, social, and political observations, or rants about mama, prison, and work? Racist or class conscious, or both? A genre heavily influenced by European music, or a genre heavily influenced by African-American instruments, blues progressions, and jazz solos? Warmed over rock and roll, or the cradle that birthed Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Chuck Berry? Country music is, I think, all of the above and perhaps more. Developing an appreciation for the literature of the country lyric has been, for me and for many others, a way to enter into the minds of people whose experience is far different from my own, precisely because country presents a remarkably broad range of American unheralded experiences. I was born in the urban mecca that was Detroit, Michigan in 1959, not a coal town in West Virginia or a small town in Texas. Over the years, paying close attention to the country lyric has been perhaps to enter into the camp of the foreign, and discover in their wounds and their yearnings, their moments of transcendence and their despair, our common cause. My adventures in Nashville began almost 30 years ago in 1978 in Cambridge, Massachusetts at Harvard University, when I signed up for a course called The Later Renaissance in England. In that course, I encountered the great 17th century English metaphysical poets, Andrew Marvell, George Herbert, and John Donne. At the same time, I rolled in Survey of American Literature that introduced me to the American metaphysical poet, Edward Taylor, and T.S. Eliot's Essay on the British Metaphysicals, published in 1921. Two other events that semester converged to change, quite literally, the course of my life. I signed up for a screenwriting course, which before the advent of personal computers required that I type a 110-page manuscript, and the city of Boston got its very first country station. I listened to that country station that referred to itself as Boston's best country as a joke. But as I typed my 110 pages of script, a task that took me the better part of 4 days, I came upon an unexpected truth. Singing along to the radio, it occurred to me that contrary to what I was being taught, metaphysical poetry was alive and well and living in Nashville. Those who remember and know a little bit about the metaphysical poets probably know that their work can often be recognized by the use of elaborate metaphor, wit, and subtle argument. In T.S. Eliot's words, quote, "A device which is sometimes considered characteristically metaphysical, the elaboration contrasted with the condensation of a figure of speech to the furthest stage which ingenuity can carry it." Coca-Cola Cowboy was a song I was listening to when this thought crystallized in my mind, but I could give you many other examples. And I'm about to play you one of my favorites. Drop Kick Me Jesus to the Goalpost of Life. A rather elaborate football metaphor about redemption comes immediately to mind. And let us get you Drop Kick Me Jesus. Oh, wait, wait.
Huh?
There you are.
Drop kick me Jesus through the doorpost of life. End over in neither left nor right. Straight to the heart of them righteous upright. Drop kick me Jesus through the doorpost of life. Make me, oh, make me, Lord, more than I am. Make me a piece in your master game plan. Free from the earthly tempestion below. I've got the will, Lord, if you got the tow. Drop kick me, Jesus, through the goalpost of life. End over in neither left nor right. Straight through the heart of them righteous upright. Drop kick me Jesus to the goalpost of life.
That was written by a true Southern gentleman and genial intellect, Paul Kraft. If you remember only two things about the country song lyric today, I commend these to your attention. One, country music can significantly be considered in relation to metaphysical poetry. And two, an aesthetic of what I call dynamic stasis is well developed in the country canon. Let me give you just a taste, a little taste, of a song that's been called the greatest country song of all time. Although I'll forewarn you, without benefit of the entire course and being placed, some of its beauty may be lost on you, but the voice will not be, the great George Jones.
Till I die.
Wait, gotta stop, gotta get that first. Doesn't use any intro.
He said, I'll love you till I die. She told him, you'll forget in time. As the years went slowly by, she still prayed upon his mind. He kept her picture on his wall. Went half crazy down in pain. He still loved her through it all. Hoping she'd come back again. Kept some letters by his bed. And in 1962, he had underlined in red.
Loving Her Today, written by Bobby Braddock and Curly Putnam, recorded by the great George Jones, is perhaps the preeminent example of dynamic stasis. He stopped loving her today because he died. Songs which investigate lives in which change does not occur, the hero or heroine is stuck, in this case with some letters by his bed dated 1962, he had underlined and read every single I love you, are sharp prods to action. Now that you're thinking about metaphysical poetry and dynamic stasis, I want to get you thinking about a third and final point on the aesthetics, what I call Afro-Celtic collaborations. Country music is an Afro-Celtic form. What do I mean by that? What we today know as country music is largely immigrant folk music, primarily English, Irish, and Scottish folk music, as it evolved in the American South, where it was strongly influenced by evangelical Christianity and African aesthetics. Which African aesthetics, you may ask? The quick answer is more expressive, open-throated singing, new instruments, particularly the banjo, an African instrument, new blues chord progressions, and new rhythms. If you want to just remember one of these, remember the banjo. And if you want to try to remember the point about more expressive, open-throated singing, take note of this little-known fact. The man Hank Williams Sr. credited as his most significant influence was a black street musician who went by the name of T-Tot. So, to nail this Afro-Celtic concept in your minds, take a listen to the Grand Old Opry song. I'm about to play that for you. Please take note of the sounds of the banjo and African influence, the mention of banjo, and the use of the word blues in relation to Hank Williams. And while you're doing that, you may just start to develop a few good questions about just where the word blue in the word bluegrass comes from. It might not just be a reference to Kentucky vegetation. And so, and here we are.
You pick one for 15 years, didn't you? Really?
That's Earl Scruggs.
Come and listen to my story, if you will. I'm gonna tell about a gang of fellers from down at Nashville. First, I'll start with old Red Foley doing the Chattanooga shoe. We can't forget Hank Williams with him. His train with Minnie Pearl and Rock Rashville and Lazy Jim Day. Turn on all your radios, I know that you will wait. Hear the new Jimmy Dickens sing, take an old Cole Taylor and play. There'll be guitars and fiddles, Earl Scruggs and his band or two. Bill Monroe singing out the American Kentucky blues. Ernest Tubbs number.
The Grand Ole Opry Saturday night. How many of you knew the banjo was an African instrument? See, there are a few of you that do know this. I would like to add one of the things that our main text and other people don't, the main influences are Southern folk music, evangelical Christianity, and African American influences. However, there's also, and this, I think I'm one of the first scholars to start working on it, there's been the influence of Tin Pan Alley, and through the influence of Tin Pan Alley, commercial songwriters working in New York that have long influenced country since it's been born, There actually is a wonderful Russian-Jewish influence in country music that has gone undocumented through the influence of Tin Pan Alley. And so I want to start acknowledging, I'm working on that, some research on that, and you'll be among the first to be introduced to that notion. Very few of the standard texts acknowledge that along with the evangelical Christianity, through Tin Pan Alley, there is a strong Russian-Jewish influence in country too. Harlan Howard, often referred to as the Dean of Nashville Songwriters, was a man who donned a replica of a Confederate battle shirt for fancy occasions. To remind you that country is an Afro-Celtic form, let's take a, and he, one of the people he loved most was Ray Charles. So to remind you that country is an Afro-Celtic form, if that banjo didn't do it, let's take a listen to the late, great Ray Charles singing the Harlan Howard classic, Busted, as it was released in 1962 on Ray Charles' seminal album, Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music. As I just said, Harlan Howard, often referred to as the Dean of Nashville Songwriters, was a man who donned a replica of a Confederate battle shirt for fancy occasions. So you can see him in it on the Nashville Songwriters Association website. Harlan loved Ray Charles. He claimed Ray as country. I know that because he told me so over drinks in Maude's Courtyard when I was still young and he was still alive, way back in the early 80s before I had my first hit country song recorded. In December this year, I published a book with two authors, Courtney and Carter Little, a book entitled My Country Roots. We are fortunate enough to have George Jones write an introduction. My Country Roots attempts to divide all recorded country songs available legally on the internet at iTunes into 100 significant themes. The large categories are very simple: who we are, what we do, how we feel, where we come from, and where we long to go, what we believe in, and what we sound like. In a moment, I'm going to take you on a quick trip through the Who We Are list, but first I want to mention a favorite list that isn't in the Who We Are section, because it underscores both the importance of country as a class music, and it again underscores how lucky we are and our kids are, the coffee, sugar, and cigarettes list. Country is a culture of coffee, sugar, and cigarettes. Poor people's legal drugs are precious luxury in an otherwise deprived world. Here's a snippet of another Tom T. Hall creation. Don't forget the coffee, Billy Joe.
Don't forget the coffee.
God was on vacation for a while. It's quite an image of the Depression. The Who We Are list include honky-tonk angels, honky-tonk men, good women, ramblers, outlaws, bandits, bad mamas, hookers, rednecks, angels, black, John Henry, teen girls, feminists, ladies of legend, mythic men, fools, mamas and daddies, soldiers, waitresses, cowboys, icons, and old people. The list explores the icons who define what it means to be country, or at least the roles country folk are most likely to be playing when you find them in the center of a country song. These cast and song heroes and heroines represent aspects of what it means to be human that often go ignored for being too simple, too ugly, too ordinary, or too far beyond the law. The songs in this section of the country canon depict the raggedy and righteous souls who populate the country landscape and our world. Honky Tonk Angels offer an invitation into a world of intoxication, danger, and companionship. Honky Tonk Angels inhabit and provide a way into a realm set apart from home, nature, or work, unless you're a waitress, or I'll get to those at the end. Partly victims, partly free agents, these transcendent and transgressing women who frequent the bars are powerful and alluring creatures of the night. Like Dante's Beatrice, they companion their men through the circles of hell. Always female in the country canon, the particular character of an individual honky-tonk angel is often revealed by examining carefully why she is in the bar, what she does while there, who she does it with, who she left behind to do it, and who's watching while it all goes on. The classic song in this genre is Kitty Wells' It Wasn't God Who Made Honky-Tonk Angels. My current favorite is the Gillian Welch Barroom Girls, which boasts this lovely conceit. Well, the night came undone like a party dress and fell to her feet in a beautiful mess, which expands to conclude, last night's spangles and yesterday's pearls are the bright morning stars of the barroom girls. To be one's own inspiration, to be one's own nature, that is a metaphysical conceit, and it is a part of what it is to be feminine in this Gillian Welch masterpiece. Hear a little bit of it. Barroom girls go by your side, and when they do, all the colors go round in a swirl. Barroom girls are powerful and powerless, with childhood way behind them like their carousel ponies in this song. They are controlling power in a yet more powerful world. Ramblers are another interesting category in the canon of country. These descendants of the adventurous Huckleberry Finn and Natty Bumppo light out to see the territory even as it vanishes, honoring the wild promise of America as an inviting wilderness to be explored. Our ramblers complicate the lives of the people to whom they are attached while retaining their own ironic simplicity. Outlaws and bandits, a related list, are ramblers with a purpose and motive. Sometimes criminal, at their most significant, they are committed to the ideal purposes not supported by the majority. These men are willing to endure wrath and punishment to maintain integrity and freedom. Poncho and Lefty, written by Towns Van Zandt, is one of the great country outlaw songs. I'm going to play you a version that was recorded by Willie Nelson. A little part of it.
Living on the road.
wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. Outlaws and bandits are of special importance to poor Southerners, both white and black, who share very different but somehow common historical experiences of having the law against them. Bad Mamas is a category that reveals country's wide-eyed lack of sentimentality. These are affecting tales, not of the women who do their men wrong, but of women who do their children, most often their daughters, wrong. Far beyond Mrs. Bennett, as of course I refer to the Jane Austen, Mrs. Bennett on steroids, these songs foreshadow the advent of mothers who killed their children in the American cultural landscape. To give you a sense of the breadth of the category, let us just consider three from the less lurid end of a spectrum that does include a song that features death slash execution by giant cargo truck of Bad Mama. That's Garth Brooks' Mama Loved Men. Bedtime Story, recorded by Tammy Wynette, is both curious and disturbing. A mother tucks her daughter into bed, then lulls her to sleep with the story of how daddy cheated on her mommy. In Birmingham Mistake, recorded by Sammy Smith, an abandoned infant turns into a depressed woman with more passion for the mother who abandoned her than for her own life. Thanks to Mama, it's a short trip from the orphan's basket to the suicide casket. Fancy presents an ill mother with one starving child and another old enough to, I will let Bobby Gentry, who wrote this mini masterpiece, tell it, the rest of it.
Turned 18. We lived in a one-room run-down shack on the outskirts of New Orleans. We didn't have money for food or rent, to say the least. We were hard-pressed, and Mama spent every last penny we had to buy me a dancing dress. Well, Mama washed and combed and curled my hair, and she painted my eyes and lived there. Then I stepped into a satin dancing dress that had a split from the side clean up to my ear. It was red velvet trimming and it fitting me good. Standing back from the looking glass, there stood a woman where a half grown kid had stood. She said, here she was, just fancy, don't let me down. She said, here she was, just fancy, don't let me down. Mama got a little bit of perfume on my neck, then she kissed my cheek, and then I saw the tears welling up in her troubled eyes.
Fancy. This rags-to-riches narrative is a stark tale of survival that in its own way rivals Defoe's Mal Flanders. I shivered as I watched a roach crawl across the toe of my high heel shoe. Prostitutes are the female outlaws and bandits of the country canon. They too break the rules for a reason, be it poverty and survival or fury and compassion. Often ironic, almost always subversive, these women challenge our understanding of love, money, and virtue. An outstanding example of this was penned by Dallas Frazier. But to leave no doubts, I put that one on the Bad Mama's list, because no matter how poor they were, she did the wrong thing by her child. But here's a mama trying to do right by her child.
Oh, the path was deep and wide, from footsteps leading to our cabin. Above the door that burned a scarlet lamp. And late at night, there would stand a stranger. Yes, I'm the son of Hickory Holler's tramp. The corn was dry and the weeds were high when Daddy took to drink. Him and Lucy woke, they took up and ran away. Mama cried a tear and then she promised 14 children. I swear you'll never see a hungry day. When Mama sacrificed for pride, the neighbors started talking. but I was much too young to understand the things they said. The thing that mattered most of all was Mama's chicken dumplings and a goodnight kiss before we went to bed.
That was Merle Haggard singing Yes, I'm the Son of Hickory Holler's Tramp. Rednecks. The R word redneck has everything to do with laboring, poor, white, Southern identity. A persona that is either a source of pride or humiliation, consideration of the redneck songs, often dismissed as the most simple-minded of jingoistic radio crack. The songs in the redneck canon have much to tell about the convergence of issues of class, caste, and race in the South. Though the phrase is often used humorously and sometimes proudly, in its most literal sense, it denotes a man whose white neck is burned red by laboring beneath the elements. And the phrase can contain 16 ton from our first song of pain. Today, these songs suggest alternative readings of the text of social mobility in the American context. Perhaps the best known of current redneck songs is Gretchen Williams's Redneck Woman. My favorite is another Gillian Welch song, Red Clay Halo. Red Dirt Stains is the conceit that is elaborated upon in Red Clay Halo, beginning with the idea that some white people are colored red by hard labor, earth, and poverty. The song rises to culminate in the notion that the stain may appear in heaven as a crowning halo. This is one of the most beautiful songs I'll play you today, I think.
Oh, the girls all dance with the boys from the city, and they don't care to dance with me. Now it ain't my fault that the fields are muddy and the red clay stains my feet.
John Donne might have liked Gillian Welch. I'd like to begin to draw to a close by taking a bit of a closer look at a waitress song. Most of us will encounter a waitress sometime or another during this festival week. The waitress, mama, working woman, exhausted creature, worthy temptress, beggar lady, victim, or abundant lover, she's a walking, talking, classic country character, an earthy and earthly antithesis of the sacred yet profane honky-tonk angels with which we began this talk. And here is the waitress song. A little bit of it.
If I didn't come home every day smelling like Friday, if I didn't have those things popping out all over my leg, if I had my hair done up real nice, if I had some clothes to wear for a few times, would you still be coming home drunk in the middle of the night?
The ladies who just sang call themselves Freak Water. That's a recent song. That song, the waitress song, is a class lament that contemplates the abstract, poverty as the anti-aphrodisiac, and the specific, a uniform losing its color as it swirls in a coin-operated washing machine. Three chords in the truth. That's how the late, great Harlan Howard, the white orphan born in Detroit, the man who wrote I Fall to Pieces and Busted, defined country music. If I didn't come home every day smelling like fried eggs, if I didn't have those veins popping all over my legs, if I had my hair done up real nice, if I had some clothes that weren't too tight, would you still be coming home drunk in the middle of the night? Freakwater recreates unwritten intimate history, acknowledging harsh material reality without loathing, shame, or pathos. That song ends, if I didn't go to bed afraid about some bills that will never get paid, I wouldn't be down at the laundromat watching my work clothes fade. Three chords and complex truths, told through the use of elaborate metaphor, stark contrasts, and simple language, often located in the lives of people touched by poverty, God, rural America, and Africa. This is country music, and this is modern American metaphysical poetry. Of course, the obvious apparent difference between metaphysical poems and the great country songs lies in tone. One lives in the cast-off atmosphere of the court, the Royal Court of England. The other lives in the shadow of the farm. More significantly, many hear in country songs the privileging of emotion over intellect that would be antithetical to the metaphysical tradition. I hear something else, and I invite you to hear it too. When we listen beneath the surface of the songs, through the music, through the accents, to the lyric, we find in the country canon example after example of the privileging of intellect over education and the privileging of truth over love. Country is a hard-headed gut bucket poetry of a hard scrabble people. And this world is full of hard scrabble people. And no one puts it sweeter than Bob McDill and his classic Good Old Boys Like Me. Those Williams boys still mean a lot to me, Hank in Tennessee. Near the end of T.S. Eliot's seminal essay on the metaphysical poets, he makes this statement. It's interesting to speculate whether it's not a misfortune that two of the greatest masters of diction in our language, the English language, Milton and Dryden, triumph with a dazzling disregard of the soul. I'll repeat that because it's worth repeating. It is interesting to speculate whether it's not a misfortune that two of the greatest masters of diction in our language, Milton and Dryden, triumph with a dazzling disregard of the soul. In contrast to this, Eliot acknowledges that Racine and Baudelaire, the great masters of French diction, were, to quote Eliot, most curious explorers of the soul. These peculiar American poets, Harlan Howard, Merle Travis, Paul Kraft, Gillian Welch, Tom T. Hall, are most curious explorers of the soul. I'd like to end with 16th Avenue. That's what they called Music Square East when I first came to Nashville. And I have went to Harvard, graduated from Harvard with a degree in English, and I've had 20 to 30 country songs recorded, including a number one and some others in the top, or at least two, another in the top 10 and some others on the charts. So 16th Avenue was written by Tom Schuyler as an ode to songwriters and to a neighborhood walking distance from where you are sitting right now. I sent it out to the class of 2007 and their parents. I sent it out to you. I sent it out to the parents of people who came to this town to start making their dreams come true. I send it out to students fortunate enough, because of who you are and what Vanderbilt University is, that they will never have to choose between intellect and education, or between truth and love. To our young people who have more than they can know now of everything significant, and that's something I figured out listening to a country song, 16th Avenue.
From the corners of the country, from the city's island farm, with years and years of living tucked up underneath their arms, they walk away from everything just to see a dream come true. So God bless the boys who make the
thank you so much for coming. If any of you have any questions about country music, email me at alicefans@aol.com. I'm also standing right here to answer any of that. I hope you have a wonderful graduation weekend. And I'm happy if anybody has any questions. I know I want to keep you on a schedule, and you're down to 4 minutes, but I'm right here. Yes. Well, I think in one sense, there's two parts of it. Part of it is what I call crossover ick, or just bad pop music warmed over. But I said it's also warmed over rock and roll. Part of it is profound. The profound part is, as America, country is a country, is a class music. As America has had, in fact, more people have risen into the upper middle class, more people have risen into lower upper class. Fortunately, we don't have as many people slaving around in coal mines. So it has moved to being a suburban music. And so you have all these wonderful songs. My favorite ones of that are Hello, Mr. Mom, Crayons Melt in a Maytag Dryer, Crayons Go Up One Shelf Higher. All of these suburban fathers trying to figure out how to daddy. You have all these wonderful songs about people losing their money in divorce, and the guy says, do you want fries with that? Those are real narratives for suburban fathers. And I think there's a lot of really interesting teenage girl stuff about balancing freedom with integrity, but part of country music is it is involved, the current market for the best of it is a suburban market preaching to what does it mean to be serene in the suburbs. And the part that is the tough, edgy, weird part, although these ones called like Waiting on Two Pink or Blue Lines, I didn't even know what that meant. Well, it was a pregnancy test. It's like, things have changed. So that's cutting edge for this day and age. These teenagers who are trying to decide, can they go off to college, waiting on two blue. I only learned about that listening to a country song. Part of it is, as more profit has gotten into the, what you have to understand, when I came to Nashville and take a, I don't want to name any names, but say John Doe, I could name you three men that I can think of right now. I came from Harvard, and I came and what, my daughter's at Harvard, and I actually think day-to-day Vanderbilt University is a better university. I teach, I know them both. I came from Harvard where there was, I can honestly say that, because at Harvard there were a lot of people who didn't have the intellect but had the education at the time I was there. And where I found true cutting-edge brilliance, because I'm a snob, I love brilliance, were people like Bobby Braddock and Bob McDill, some of whom, note those two that I've named, people I can't name, who came up so poor. They were white poor men who had never had a chance to go to college. And the only place they could be brilliant and the only place they could be a millionaire was to come to Nashville and write amazing songs and to sometimes sing them, but particularly the songwriters. So I was spending my days with people who were uneducated but drop-dead brilliant. Those same people, and again, I can't name, would never and didn't want their children to have to come and work in the turmoil of Nashville to try to have lightning strike and become successful. It's the same way we get urban black young men sometimes who thought their only opportunity is to go play basketball when they have opportunities to be doctors and lawyers. So it used to be, if you were a brilliant person with language and poor and white in this country, what you might do in 1940 is get yourself to Bakersfield. Or if you were Harlan Howard, who was an orphan in Detroit, right? He got himself to Bakersfield, got himself to Nashville. Buddy Killen got himself to Nashville, and he made a career in language. So part of it is a positive story that people have other opportunities. So the kind of music that we had in that time period, the same thing with soul music. You don't get a James Brown and Aretha Franklin, because Aretha Franklin is probably a principal in some high school in Chicago today, and that's a good thing. So there's good and bad to it, but it means the music. I stopped teaching about 4 years ago. There are very few songs that make the cutting. Yes. I can't, there are many economic issues to that, but yeah, I am an English, and I'm a person with language and tech, so I could speak to that. Why there is not a country station in New York City, the money is not, I think it's because they're feeling the lack of, that it's the warm over rock and roll, that speaks to suburbanites, and it does speak to country people, that, and you know, we've had a migration from the rural areas of the entire country into the city, so yes, the suburban. Well, in terms of purchasing, yeah, and in terms of, and also they're wonderful country music clubs. When my child was first born, her father was at the UN, and I used to, you can go right now to all kinds of wonderful underground clubs and hear country music. And one of the things, country is huge in Europe, London, Paris, people adore, because it is America's great poetry. And wherever people are interested in, it's, you know, with jazz music, it is one of our great artistic creations and gifts. I hope some of you find yourself out to hear some country music. But I agree that Opry is a complicated thing today, and it's not what it used to be. But iTunes, you know, you can hear everything from 1930 forward on iTunes, and I suggest you really look at that. That's one of the things with George Jones, why he wrote the introduction, because it used to be, as he said, if he went fishing in the middle of his lake, he couldn't take all of his albums from 1943. You know, some things didn't get from album to CD, or they got to cassette in the middle. You have your entire collection of essentially recorded country music. 90% of it is available on iTunes, and you can only listen to stuff from 37 and 58. But there's some amazing songs. There's a brilliant anti-war song, and I'm not pro or against the war. I could show brilliant songs on both sides. But one called Heather, Are You With Me Tonight? Written in the voice of a man who's a pilot, and he's asking his girlfriend, can she be up in that plane with him? And it's the equal of Galveston. And at the same time, I love that song about the pro-war song, one of my favorite. I did about the son getting a letter from his father, and the father finally says, I love you, and he said, no one laughs when a soldier cries. That he had to go, and he was doing his duty so profoundly that his father came and said those words in a letter to him. And so there are places where, for example, I think our soldiers today, that country songs are sustaining them, but in every aspect of their experience, they are reflected in country songs. So, thank you so much. I know you've got places to go.